the overall usefulness of the book is to provide a space in which anybody interested in architecture can learn, not just about the past, but also about the possibilities of the present.
What most books label the history of architecture is often a celebration of a narrow and subjective canon of works. But should we think differently about how we designate what's desirable and deign what's architecturally anonymous? We'll hunker down for an alternative read on the recent history of architecture today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also, today...
We tend to celebrate what is a structure, what is standing up there, and we forget the anthropology of the journey.
An architecture prize roundup. We'll find out how the winner of this year's Africa Architecture Award is doing justice to Durban's past by building a brighter future. And speak to one of the judges of this year's Ralph Erskine Award, a sought-after affair that offers a quadrennial prize for works that serve less privileged communities. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, anyone that's ever worked on a book will know that what's left out of the final volume is often as revealing as what's printed. Modern architecture is, sometimes literally and sometimes figuratively, a broad church. There are all manner of incidental, important and unsung structures that end up sadly omitted from the final work. Colin Davis is the author of a handsome new title named A New History of Modern Architecture, published by Lauren King. He popped into the studio to meet this show's producer, Ben Rylan, for a thoughtful rethink on the received wisdom of recent architectural history.
This conjunction of the two words new and history is a bit strange, because people tend to think history is the past, and there can't be a new past. The past is past, and we can't do anything about it. But of course, history in the other sense of how we interpret the past, how we research the past, discuss the past, that changes all the time. The publisher and I thought it was time that we had a new history of modern architecture, just that. And since that's the way we discussed it in our plans, that's the title we used. Things have changed quite radically in the history of architecture recently, largely because of the repositioning of that most important style called modernism. I'm not an anti-modernist, some architectural historians are, but nevertheless we see it now in a different perspective, and most histories of architecture tend to favour it, tend to give it a disproportionate attention. I mean, my book also gives it lots of attention, it's a very important subject, but somehow the gravitational field that it created, say 30 years ago, was much larger than it is now, because modernism itself is moving into history, is becoming history. And so the perspective changes. So we thought it was time for a new history of modern architecture.
And of course, what's clear when you're leafing through the book is that there is a distinct difference between modernism and modern architecture. I think a lot of people will hear modern architecture and think of a particular kind of building. But if you just leaf into the book, into the table of contents, you don't need to go in there very far at all, and you start to realise that modern architecture actually covers quite a few decades, quite a few different styles. In fact, it goes, I mean, it starts off, chapter one, Art Nouveau, and you can go through to Art Deco, modern classicism. There's a lot to it. Why do you think that our perception has become quite narrow when we think of what modern architecture is?
I think it's because of those previous histories of modern architecture and the concentration they had on modernism, European modernism, a very specific manner of designing and building buildings that grew up in the years immediately after the First World War, had its roots before the First World War, and came to sort of full fruition in the 1950s and 60s. Now, when people were writing histories of architecture, they tended to favour this style. That means that when anybody thinks of modern architecture, they tend to think of European modernism. If any of your listeners know, for example, the Bauhaus building in Dessau, a very familiar image, that's the absolutely typical modernist building. The trouble is, most 20th century architecture is not modernist. So do we conclude from that it isn't modern? Well, no, of course not. It is modern in all sorts of other ways. It's modern in its building technology. It's modern in the functions of the buildings. There are lots of modern buildings that are not modernist. Some of them cling to very traditional styles, like classicism. There's a lot of important buildings of the 20th century still remain in the classical tradition.
I always find it interesting that we seem to align certain architectural movements with a particular kind of building sometimes. So I think Art Deco got the chapter open in front of me here, and of course there are pictures here of cinemas. There are a lot of Art Deco cinemas, and for some reason Art Deco seems to suit the cinematic medium quite beautifully. And for some reason, a lot of Art Deco cinemas have managed to stick around, which is fantastic. But we don't necessarily associate the Art Deco movement with a suburban house, for instance. Why is that? Why do certain types of architectural movements seem to belong to certain types of buildings?
Well, I think sometimes it is a question of style. Let me take another, a completely different example. The high-tech style of the 1970s and 80s. The style of Richard Rogers and Norman Foster, who are now the grand old men of British architecture, but then were the Young Turks. They introduced a kind of architecture that was steel-framed, used metal and glass components, didn't like bricks, didn't like concrete. And not surprisingly, the commissions that came their way were often factories, because steel frames and metal panels lend themselves to simple enclosures like factories. And there's a kind of exchange that takes place between the impulse behind the style, the idea of Richard Rogers or Norman Foster wanting to create architecture out of clipped together kits of parts made of metal, between that technology and its application to a particular building type. So, for example, people reckon the very first high-tech building was a factory called Reliance Controls in Swindon. Now, a factory in Swindon for an electronics company would not normally enter architectural history. But in this case, it's become an extremely important example. Unfortunately, it no longer exists. So I think there are correspondences between style and building type. Incidentally, I don't agree that suburban houses are not Art Deco. The suburbs of London are full of Art Deco details on the front of 1930s semi-detached houses. So it's not necessarily the case.
It's interesting. What I meant really was that we don't necessarily tend to associate those types of buildings. We don't associate our houses with the Art Deco movement, even though, of course, there are. A lot of people yes. probably wouldn't recognise yeah. them. I remember there was a, this is going off topic slightly, but there was actually a television series that was shooting where in my hometown of Melbourne once, and they were using Melbourne to represent Los Angeles of the late 1930s, early 1940s. Mm. And unfortunately, they chose to use Victorian architecture a lot yes. in their representation of that. And I could never work out why, because in other parts of Melbourne, there are quite a few examples of architecture of that actual period that would have been in LA back then. But yes. for yes. anyone watching it, it was quite clearly not LA.
Yes.
I wanted to touch upon also, so you've compiled a new history of modern architecture. And of course, as you've described, history tends to be all about looking back. But the whole point of this book, and the whole point of learning about what has happened before, is so it can tell us something about what's happening next. Mm. What are your thoughts now on where architecture is heading?
Well, one of my thoughts is that it's changing like a chameleon every 3 years. What a style that only 5 years ago was the very latest thing is now looking terribly dated. I visited a building that shall remain nameless only yesterday, which looks like an inaccurate representation of a computer model, with all the sort of fancy slopes and converging forms and so on. And already it looks dated, although it's basically a brand new building. So I think one of the things that's happening is that style is taking over from style at an ever-increasing pace. Possibly this has something to do with the revolution in the technology of design, the digital revolution. I don't mean just in general computers, but specifically three-dimensional design, CAD/CAM software, which is enabling a kind of form-making that was impossible before. And for a little while, we've been drunk on this new capability of imagining forms, forms that we could never have dreamt of before, when a wall had to be a wall and it was mostly vertical and a floor had to be a flat. It's no longer the case because we can make much more complicated organic forms. That doesn't mean to say we haven't always done it. There have always been organic forms in architecture. It isn't absolutely new, but we've been drunk on it. And now I think we're reacting against it, of course, and going back to a more, dare I use the word, classical style, at least a more straightforward, a more austere style. And these two tendencies are fighting it out.
So you mentioned that when you put this book together, you had students in mind. You had people that were looking at entering the field, and you know, maybe their ideas are just starting to gestate in their minds. Is there maybe one or two key lessons that you would suggest contained within the book that you would put forth to someone like that?
The thing is that nobody ever made anything, did they, complicated anyway, without having a sneaky, sly look at what other people have done in the past. You know, looking at what other architects have done in the past is sort of essential. It's unimaginable that we wouldn't do it. So I think, in a way, my advice would be boringly general. I mean, it would be read your history. Not just read it, but look at the buildings and try to understand them and understand what makes them different one from another. Not simply use of materials or technology or space or facadism or whatever it might be, but all of these things combined. How have architects in the past dealt with the raw materials of architecture? And that doesn't necessarily mean solid materials. It means space and scale and human use, as well as steel and concrete and plastic and computers. So the relevance of the book, in some ways, the overall relevance of the book, the overall usefulness of the book, is to provide a space in which anybody interested in architecture can learn, not just about the past, but also about the possibilities of the present. The book is like a building. It's like a building which you can go into and learn enjoyably.
Colin Davies there, author of A New History of Modern Architecture, published by Lawrence King, and available at any self-respecting bookshop, speaking to our very own Ben Rylan. In today's Aside, two books we've selected for the design section of our own libraries. Firstly, and despite never having actually met the late Swiss-born architect Albert Frey and Brazilian modernist Lina Bobardi's work, is united by an appreciation of nature and a concern with blurring the binaries of indoor and outdoor spaces. Enter a new title from Prestel and Delmonico that's published with a hand from the Palm Springs Art Museum. It's entitled Albert Frey and Lina Bobardi, A Search for Living Architecture. The writers are Daniel Cornell and Zella R. Lima. Under the covers are five stirring essays, plus a wealth of glossy snaps from hand-scribbled sketches to blueprints and black-and-white photographs. Each helps tease out and tot up the achievements of these overlooked but thrillingly perspicacious practitioners. Secondly is a green and glossy title named Outside Material, The Cover Art of Preservation Music, with an introduction by Dan Rule. Now, a cynic might say that these Sydney-based preservation music label only released records, so they'd have something to package the living daylights out of. What do we have here? Canny typographers, spare graphic design, and a subtle use of photography, as well as a tasteful colour palette. Preservation never released Iron Maiden albums, put it that way. There is a lot to love, not just soberly appreciate, in this retreading of the best work of label founders and designers Andrew Keed-Horry and Mark Gowing. It's a masterclass in the depleted craft of sleeve design. Now, the metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Ryland. He's at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. The inaugural Africa Architecture Awards recently took place, with the main prize going to Umkhambane Culture and Heritage Museum in South Africa's coastal city of Durban. A striking circular tower is the focus point of the project, which cost over $5 million and sits like a giant speckled silo perched on a grassy patch. The building aims to do two distinct things: to shed light and learning on the difficult history of the local Zulu population, plus ambitiously to act as a space for business and the wider community. No mean feat, we think you'll agree. But as Monocle reporter Gavin Fisher discovered, the centre faces a challenge in meeting its ever-so-ambitious goals.
The lady at the front there, when I told her we had won the award, she said she couldn't believe it. And I said, you're sitting on something here that just about 20 days ago was just a building. Now everybody wants to visit it.
So Rodney Koromansky is the chief architect on the Umkhambane Heritage Museum, a project he's been working on for over 15 years.
The aesthetic of this building is basically generated from creating a building with no back to it, so it's circular. Almost in all of Africa, the circle is a very powerful element. It comes from ceremony, it comes from making craft. So the circle is basically made up by the three materials. One is the concrete, it's a skeleton, and then the skin is the clay. In Zulu culture, they use clay and they paste it on their face as a sun protection. So then we use that, and then the third element was the metal screen. So when the sun comes over the screen, it creates textile pattern. Whereas corrugated iron is an amazing material, and in our townships it's used because it's lightweight, it's easy to construct. So we said, let's use that as a powerful element. So using history, using tradition, and using a free spirit of sort of an arts thing that we have in South Africa.
Architecturally, it was an outstanding submission.
Phil Mashabane is one of South Africa's leading architects and a judge on the recent African Architecture Awards.
And of course, it was standing out because of the journey it took to arrive at the final product, because usually we tend to celebrate what is a structure, what is standing up there, and we forget the anthropology of the journey, which makes the project very successful.
Phil has worked on many of South Africa's most celebrated museums and was part of the early design plans for the Umkhambane Centre. At the time, the structure was set to be much flatter, to merge into the surroundings, and Phil says the new tall building has a challenge fitting in.
The context needs to suggest exactly what the building should be. But then many of the projects, regrettably even this one, is standing out. We don't know to what degree will the community grow to match the building. That community hasn't grown for decades, if not centuries.
Making the building stand up has become a very proud way of expressing Zulu culture.
Again, Rodney Koromansky.
We want to add townscape to this area. We want to create a landmark of sculpture, of reference to Zulu and to people that were at the lowest end of economic levels, etc.
The story of the people of Umkhambane is a long and difficult one. The space to tell that story is set across three levels of the building.
So this is the first floor of the exhibition space.
I'm shown round by Stephen Kodzer, one of the exhibition's researchers tasked with filling the space.
It does feel more like an art gallery than a space created with the portrayal of historical events in mind. On this floor, once you exclude the architectural features and the pillars and the hole in the floor that joins this floor to the atrium, as well as the stairwell, you left with about 180 square meters of exhibition space.
And that's something that concerns you?
Yeah, my view as an exhibitions person, which is completely subjective, is that once you elevate a structure in the landscape to make it a significant and tall structure, you increase the need for space which cannot be used for exhibition. So all of that basically takes up space that would be welcome to tell the story.
Because it's a hugely complicated story.
It's a very complicated story. This community here is the first place that Zulu-speaking people came to live in a city in this province. And it's that community that fell foul of apartheid legislation in the second half of the 20th century, and protests against those laws took place, and then the forcible removal of those communities in the late 1950s and into the 1960s. It is Durban's equivalent of District 6 or Sophia Town.
While the space certainly doesn't seem ideal for a complex historical exhibition, Rodney Koromanski says the brief was to design a more versatile space.
In this exhibition, the local history museum has now going to put in the story of the struggle, but the future would be that the permanent collection will be housed in another part of the site, and the tower gallery would become a series of contemporary changing exhibitions, similar to what you'd have in the Pompidou. The concept is how strong can we get the community here around us and surrounding to become part of this as one South African Durban culture.
There are high expectations of this building. The amount of money that's been spent, there's the myriad aims that it has to fulfill, and even the award that it's just won. All these aspects seem to heap pressure on it to succeed. I've walked inside the empty museum space and heard about the challenges that that poses. And while standing here looking up at the building, it looks complete, you get a sense that the foundations have only been laid and that the work really to succeed begins now. For Monocle, at the Umkabani Heritage Museum in Durban, I'm Gavin Fisher.
Thank you for that special report, Gavin. Finally, on today's show, Ralph Erskine was a Scottish architect who spent most of his working life in Sweden, charmed by the country's generous social welfare model and, of course, its striking functionalist architecture. Part of his legacy is a prize awarded to buildings of innovative social, ecological and aesthetic character, and especially those that address the concerns of disadvantaged groups. This year's Erskine Award was given earlier this month to a community centre for refugees built in a deserted US military base in Mannheim, Germany. To find out more, Monocle's Bad Penny of a former producer, Henry Rees-Sheridan, spoke to Johannes Tovat, a Stockholm-based architect and jury member.
It's an international prize, and it was established by Ralph Erskine in the late 80s when he received the Wolf Prize, an Israeli prize for architecture, art and science. He was one of the first architects ever receiving this, as far as I can remember. The Ralph Erskine, due to this, the money he received from the Wolf Prize, he founded his own prize. He received $100,000. And then he founded his own award through I don't know what the English term is. And then he actually summarized his entire career, his beliefs in humanism and in social awareness into a text, a treaty. So the Erskine Prize is being given to architects, preferably in their younger, in the early stage of the profession, and who've done something for the less privileged and for something that is beautiful and something that's built and for the less privileged.
So you were on the jury of this year's award, which has just been given out. The building that won it is called the Spinelli Community Building in Mannheim in Germany. To begin with, just tell me a little bit about this building, what its purpose is and what it looks like.
It's a fantastic building or a space or a place. It's in the middle of the former American military camp, Spinelli, very close to the city center of Mannheim. And it was actually, the initiative came through students at the School of Architecture in Kaiserslautern, which is nearby. And they wanted to do something for the refugees. Then it just developed from a typical student idea to real drawings, a real concept, and sponsors turned up, and interest from the city turned up, and then they realized it. You can say it's a building, but it's sort of between a building and landscape. It's very, very difficult to describe what it is, but it's an act of will and passion, and I would say even love.
Try and describe what it looks like. What's it made out of? What shape is it? How big is it?
It's about 250 square meters, and it's a timber construction, and it's very transparent. It's both inside and outside, and it's very robust in many ways, but also very fragile, and you see through and picks up patterns and, let's say, ornaments from Far East. They didn't want to use machines, etc. So it's a very labor-demanding building. It's been designed to take time for people, for craftsmanship.
And my understanding is that the refugees themselves were consulted and involved in the planning and building of the centre. Is that correct?
Precisely. Exactly. That's what I tried to say here with some half Swedish, half English. But it was really designed to create work, to create friction and engagement between the refugees and the students and participants from all of the society. So it's...
I'm interested, what do you think are the specific architectural challenges which are posed by a refugee centre?
They pick up on many of these aspects. For example, how do you meet how do you talk to someone when you're from Afghanistan or far away? How do you sit down on a bench with a foreigner if you are a refugee? You are, of course. And how do you meet a person from Mannheim? And so it's actually all these thoughts have been embodied in the building, that so you can feel safe in one way, or you can have a sort of secret conversation in a little cave-like bench. At the same time, you can't hide away completely because it's a safety issue. So it's sort of into the very details, the idea of meeting and talking at the same time being from different cultures and different backgrounds.
I wonder if you have any idea of the general quality of refugee centres in Germany and in Europe more broadly, the architectural quality. Do they tend to be fit-for-purpose structures, or is there something to be left to be desired there?
As far as I know, this is a very unique example. I haven't seen any sort of purpose-built refugee centres in Germany, to be perfectly honest. Probably there are. I've not seen them. These community centres are probably more located into the existing urban fabric and less purpose-built, so... I think this is quite unique.
I also am interested in, you know, the Erskine Award takes into account social, ecological and aesthetic aspects of buildings, tries to look at buildings holistically in evaluating them. And obviously, you know, presumably the award seeks to set itself apart by taking these things into account. But would you also like to see more mainstream architecture awards take these considerations into account more, to give them more weighting when they're being awarded?
I think that is super important for the future, that we are doing things for everyone, first of all, and but that we also, as architects, and train to see huge social challenges which are all around us constantly. And I think definitely that should be a more pronounced theme when buildings and individuals are selected for architectural prizes. I think it's super important.
That was Johannes Torvat speaking to Monocle's One, It's Only, Henry Rhys Sheridan, about this year's Erskine Award. Next week, we're in gear for a fast-moving and pinpoint punctual transport special. We'll get under the bonnet of the Ferrari brand at a new London exhibition celebrating the Italian carmaker's 70th anniversary.
There is a history of car design, a microcosm of car design, embedded within the broader show on Ferrari history. And I think that's the first time these techniques have been exposed in a major public exhibition in Great Britain.
Section D was painstakingly produced by Ben Ryland and that bad penny of a former producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan. It was researched by Daphne Karnesis and edited by Sarah Miles. I'm Josh Fannett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.